There's news about what'll happen to companies who shift employees onto the federal health care system instead of keeping them on the company coverage.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Some companies wanted to give workers a tax-free contribution they could use to shift over to the new healthcare exchanges. Now, with support of the White House, the IRS will penalize companies $100 a day, more than $36,000 a year, if they try that cost-shifting strategy. Now, this is per employee. Those numbers today courtesy of the New York Times. Dan Mendelson is CEO of the consulting firm Avalere Health. Mr. Mendelson, good morning.
Good morning.
So, did you expect the Obama administration to make this move?
It's not a big surprise. They really need to do everything they can to make the employer-based system more stable, and this is a big one.
And there were some companies that were thinking, well, this would be a cool idea. We can just offload the health care of these employees onto the exchanges.
Sure. I mean, if you can make sure that people get coverage and pay less money, you're going to do that. I think what this does, though, is it states that it's an obligation of these large employers to keep their health care coverage stable, or they'll face a very stiff penalty.
But again, you saw this as being a tension in the system, and you were watching to see how it would be resolved?
Yeah, and the president himself has been saying that he wants the Affordable Care Act to supplement the employer-based coverage system, not to replace it. And if they had allowed employers to just pick and choose and decide to move their employees into the exchange at a whim, that certainly could have subverted the employer-based system.
Dan Mendelson is CEO of Avalere Health. Mr. Mendelson, thank you.
My pleasure.
The effect of the proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner Cable on consumers is still pretty theoretical, but the effect on the lobbying business, that is already known, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
There's a simple way you could describe Comcast's strategy. Have an unlimited budget, then exceed it. The Sunlight Foundation's Bill Allison says the nation's capital eats it up.
You know, Washington is the kind of girl that always falls for the dozen flowers sent three or four times a day.
By the looks of it, Comcast got all the floors on speed dial. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the company spent nearly $20 million lobbying the federal government last year, putting it in the top 10, and it's on track to be there again this year. Former FCC Chief of Staff Blair Levin says this is less about influencing Congress than convincing regulators and Comcast competitors this is a done deal.
Because if you have the impression that this deal is going to go through and everybody is rearranging their lives, it's much harder for a government to act in a way that upsets those expectations.
Levin says there is something of a firewall. Regulators at the Department of Justice are historically immune to lobbying campaigns, regardless of size. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The financial markets are closed here for Memorial Day, but European stock and bond markets have taken in stride the victory of many anti-European Union candidates in elections for the European Parliament. By about midday European time, the DAX in Germany was up more than 1%, and the key stock index in Paris was trading up about 0.5%. Possible you may have missed this a while back in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Volume 51, Number 6. The concept is called defensive pessimism, but it's really about the business value of using anxiety as motivation. Wharton Business School Professor Adam Grant keeps an eye on the business journals for us. Professor, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be back.
So you have research that you're looking at that negative thinking has some utility?
It does, actually. There's a group of people that we call defensive pessimists. So think back to when you were in school, for example, and you have a big test coming up. The optimists are the people who are imagining that perfect grade. The defensive pessimists are more likely to think, okay, here are the 17 ways that I might not only fail, but actually get a zero. And that anxiety motivates them to study. They end up acing the test, but on the next test, they're convinced that this time they're going to fail. And that's how they keep themselves focused.
Actually, that does resonate with my experience those billions of years ago in college. When I thought I was going to ace it, I would be disappointed. When I was scared, I tended to do well. How do we incorporate this notion that embracing the negativity in moderation, I suppose, can help us in our work?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is figure out what kind of job we're in. There are jobs that require resilience and perseverance, and their optimism is extremely useful. For example, my colleague Marty Seligman is famous for doing some research showing that in life insurance sales, where you just get rejected all the time, the optimists tend to sell 37% more than pessimists over 2 years. But there are lots of jobs where people actually have to think about what are all the bad things that could happen and prepare for it. This is true in entrepreneurship, in settings where you're doing hard science or healthcare work, and you really have to think about all the terrible possibilities that it could occur.
I know. Another word for some of this negativity is simply prudence. You have an eye out for what could go wrong, and you try to preempt what might go wrong.
Yeah, I think at both extremes, we find danger, right? The pessimists are fatalistic, optimists are toxic. We need a balance between anxiety and hope. We want the people who are willing to point out all of the problems, but also excited about finding the solutions and seeing potential for a better future.
Adam Grant is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and is author of the book Give and Take. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
And there's word that the father of one of the most popular toys in history has died at 86. Donald Levine was an executive at Hasbro who led the team that came up with a doll targeted toward boys. You know the brand, G.I. Joe. Levine was an Army vet who served in Korea. He said the toy was designed to honor veterans. G.I. Joe first appeared in time for Christmas 1964. Now, when I was 10, my parents signed me up to appear in some TV commercials for astronaut G.I. Joe for reasons I can't explain. There's a link to one of those videos on our Facebook page, APM Marketplace, if you're interested. I'm the little guy on the left, 25 seconds in. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.